Moulin Rouge is a beloved 2001 jukebox movie musical that tells the story of a young, idealistic English writer Christian who travels to Paris and falls in love with the star of the Moulin Rouge, Satine. It's set in 1900 and is a dizzying film full of reimagined modern music, ecstatic dance, and the best camera cuts Baz Luhrmann has to offer. Christian and Satine's young love is complicated by a jealous, powerful duke, financial difficulties, and a mysterious illness. 17 years after the film was released, the stage version premiered earlier this year in Boston, starring Aaron Tveit and Karen Olivo. Here to talk with me today is podcaster, unicorn, and Moulin Rouge superfan Kathy Campbell. I hope you enjoy our conversation about the Moulin Rouge. Hello, Kathy. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Quinn. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I am excited to talk about Moulin Rouge.
Me too. Oh my goodness. I watched the movie again last night and it's so funny because I have three copies of the film somewhere in my house. My husband and I each had an individual one, and then we also had the Red Curtain trilogy that came out a year after Moulin Rouge. That had Moulin Rouge, Strictly Ballroom, and Romeo and Juliet, plus two discs of special features. I could not find any of them. I don't know where they are. So I had to purchase it on iTunes, and I'm very glad that I did because there was a whole bunch of extra special features that I did not. That I had never seen that came out on the 2010 re-release. So it was a very exciting day.
And now you have four copies of Moulin Rouge.
Yes, but we're not going to talk about that.
Well, to start off with, like usual, how did you first discover Moulin Rouge?
I came home from college and had a date with a friend's brother. And we decided to go to the movie, and it was Moulin Rouge. And I fell in love with the movie, not so much the guy, which was fine, because the movie was amazing. And so it made the date worth it. And this was, too, this was considered, Moulin Rouge was considered a very, a risky venture. This was before musicals were big again. Like the idea of a musical movie was, I just remember hearing how like the critics were like, oh, this is going to be terrible. Nobody's going to watch this. And then it ended up being the smash hit that it was, which really, I think, helped build the ability for all of the movie musicals that came down the line in the future.
I first saw Moulin Rouge when I was a teenager, and I don't remember how old, but I definitely remember it was one of my friends who had seen it and was like, you've got to watch this movie, and then put it on, and I was like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I love it.
Weird is such a good explanation for it. Have you seen the other Baz Luhrmann movies, the other two?
I've seen Romeo and Juliet, but that's the only other one.
Okay. So Strictly Ballroom is the ugly stepchild of the trilogy to most people. It doesn't have a lot of the big stars. It doesn't have a lot of like the over the top. I mean, it's still very over the top. But it doesn't have so much of the insanity that I think Romeo and Juliet and definitely Moulin Rouge have. But it is one of my favorites. It's very Australian, at a level that the other two aren't. But it has a, it takes place in the world of competitive ballroom dancing. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful film. The costumes are amazing and whatnot. And it kind of reminds me, it sets up the amazingness of Moulin Rouge in a way that if Strictly Ballroom didn't exist, I don't think Moulin Rouge would have been as amazing as it was with the dancing specifically.
It certainly sounds like it's a precursor because Moulin Rouge kind of seems like
they were like, let's take, we'll start with a musical and then we'll add 1,000 pounds of red fabric and as much glitter as we can, and every dance style that we can think of. And that's going to be Moulin Rouge.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, the whole idea of the Baz Luhrmann Red Curtain trilogy is, Strictly Ballroom is with the creativity of dance. Romeo and Juliet is the creativity of language, and then Moulin Rouge is the creativity of music. And so he came about all three of these films very, very scientifically, very specifically, just like full blown, this is what I'm going to do. And he has a very strong visual style, very hyper aware of exactly what he wants. And it plays off really well. I think anyways, because that is, you see something and it's very much, oh, this is Baz Luhrmann. Which is fun, especially. And I'm really curious to see how that translates to the stage show. Cause when I was watching the movie, I was just like, a lot of this, you know, it has a lot of quick cuts and close, like zooms and a lot of overlays and things that I don't know how it would translate that same feel, the frenetic, frantic, over the top essence that the movie has. And so I'm really curious to find out how the actual show is.
Yeah, that was the thing that I was thinking about going into, that Moulin Rouge is so defined by film language and the kind of camera cuts you were talking about. And I don't want to get quite to the stage version yet. I want to spend a little more time talking just about the movie first, but we will get into that because that was one of the big things I was thinking about. But we should spend a time focusing just on the movie first, since that is what most people have experienced from this and was the only form that existed for 17 years. It is interesting that it did start as a movie, because most movie musicals that are out there, we have a ton of them now, but most of them were stage shows that were then turned into movies. And it was almost sort of, it started to become a safe bet. You know, you have a successful stage musical, and then you put Meryl Streep in it and you make it into a big movie musical, and then people are going to go see it.
Right. The only one I can think of that also went this opposite way is Newsies. And then it came around full circle in that the Broadway show is on Netflix now. But that is one that I always really was like, really? Why is this not a Broadway show? So the fact that it took as long as it did for Newsies to get there. Oh, I guess the Lion King and like the Disney.
Yeah, I guess the shows. Disney series is kind of the opposite, where, but that is also like, those are, well, besides Newsies, I guess that does qualify as an exception. But
oh, I guess Newsies is Disney.
Yeah, but it's also like Newsies is a live action movie, but the rest of them are, you know, animated musicals, sort of like a lot of Disney princess stuff, classic Disney, and then that got turned. They're all continuing in succession with our latest in Frozen to be turned into stage musicals, yes. Which again, pretty safe bet. It seems as much as a safe bet as you can get on Broadway at this point to have right. A family friendly Disney musical on there is pretty much it.
Yeah. Although if you talk to some people, the fact that Elsa wears pants in her scene is like leaning on not family friendly, because of course that means that she's a lesbian, because only lesbians would wear pants
only
in their
lesbians
I want
wear
song
pants? This is news to me.
I read an article that a friend linked to and was just like, I cannot believe that this is someone actually wrote it, and it was an op piece from the right that was just like, how dare you put my Disney princess in pants? I'm like, have you not seen Mulan? Or like, this is no, I,
or
it
the
made
last
me irrationally
100 years.
Angry. Right. right? Oh, but the Disney princesses, that's the thing, is they don't wear pants. And I was like, well, she's a Disney queen, so that's totally different. But yeah, there was controversy that she, during Let It Go, she has pants. And it's a fantastic outfit. Oh my goodness. That's something I would totally wear to like a wedding.
That's one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
It was pretty irrational.
Oh, okay. I could be thinking about that for a while. But coming back to Moulin Rouge. So yes, with the exception of the Disney pattern, most musical films started on stage and then became movies. And then, but not only was this in reverse, it also took 17 years for this movie musical, which was quite successful, to eventually be turned into a stage musical. Like, I was beginning to think it was never going to happen. And then I was like, oh, hell yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it had to do with, again, I talked a little bit about how, like, particular Baz Luhrmann is. So I wonder if it got to the point where he had to agree. Well, obviously he had to agree with what they were going to do, but like if they had to rework everything to make it happen. And that's why it took so long.
Yeah, this is not a small feat.
I can imagine.
One of the other distinguishing features of this movie, besides the Baz Luhrmann-ness of all of the visuals, is the music. The music is so weird and wonderful because it's not original music. It's made out of popular songs.
Yeah, there's only one original song, which is Come What May, and everything else is almost a remix cover of everything, which is, you know, nowadays, that's pretty normal. You look at Glee, you look at, I mean, so many of the movies will throw that in there, even if it's not the full soundtrack. But the fact that this was one of the first to do it, especially to do it this way, to take a popular song and make it fit the style that it needed to fit, and like the tempo and whatnot. Specifically, I'm thinking of The Show Must Go On, which the Queen version is very different than the one in Moulin Rouge. And then, of course, Roxanne as well.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on that red light. Walk the streets for money. You don't care if it's wrong or if it's right.
Actually, all of them are very different. There isn't a good example of one that is, oh, this is, you can tell immediately what it is based on the first three notes or whatever. It's all very different.
Maybe your song is quite similar.
Yeah, that might be the closest.
It's probably the closest, but a lot of them are used in different contexts and have completely different orchestrations and the tones of what they're doing. When I first saw Moulin Rouge, I was quite young and I actually didn't know a lot of the songs in there. And so I recognized some of them, but I actually didn't know that most of them, or almost all of them, were existing popular songs, which is funny because then I would hear the original versions. I'd be like, what is this?
Yes, for sure. And then we have the Elephant Love Medley too, which is kind of the hyper mashup cover version of like the rest of the movie. So it takes, you know, snippets and lines from movies and from the songs and interweaves it in a magical way to make one of the most beautiful songs I can think of. It's so great.
It's great. And it's especially great how they use lines to argue with each other. So it's the duet between the two characters going back and forth. And then as they, it builds and builds until they're singing together. Though nothing will keep us. Elephant, which is just beautiful.
Because why not?
Because elephants, just because.
Yes.
And all this stuff, this stands out from a lot of other jukebox musicals, because a jukebox musical is when the music in the show already exists. Like, Mamma Mia is all ABBA songs. But most of the time with jukebox musicals, it is based around a particular artist. And so you have, you know, musicals that are made out of Queen songs or ABBA songs or Billy Joel or any of that kind of thing. Whereas this is just, it is very particular songs that were chosen instead of sticking with a particular artist or genre or time period. It's from all over the place.
Yeah, which definitely gives it that a different feel, because it has it's pulling the inspiration from so many different locations, and it's the same way that the dancing feels that way, because the dancing is pulled from so many different genres as well. I think if it was made now, there would be even more genres of dance involved. There's a couple that it picks from, but it's still, I mean, Baz Luhrmann just came in and is like, I want this, and I want a little of this, and I want a touch of that, and let's put a little of this in here, and makes it work in a way that not everybody could. I mean, there's people that could try it, and it would be so easy to be a complete disaster.
And with all of this, there's a note on the Wikipedia page that it took Baz Luhrmann almost 2 years to get all the rights for all of these songs.
Yes.
He was pulling them from so many different places.
Yeah, there was a song. So in the special features, there was a song, Father and Son by Cat Stevens, that originally Baz wanted to open the show, and it was going to be to delve more into the relationship between Christian and his father, and so they were going to have that be the opener, and Cat Stevens just was not down to it. He didn't feel right. He felt like it didn't fit the original meaning of the song, and just didn't feel comfortable. They did have a marquette, like a mock-up of the song, though, that is, again, it's on the special features, and it's beautifully done, and it would have been great, but I'm kind of glad that it didn't. Like, it was up until they started filming that they kept trying to get the rights to that song, and the fact that they didn't, it kind of works, because I like the beginning. I like how they started the movie the way that they did.
A really interesting thing about this movie is that one of the very first lines is Christian being sad alone in his room and going, "The woman I love is dead." And then you're like, oh, okay.
Okay, so we're starting with that.
That's how we're starting. Right. Which makes it weird, because it's like, I guess it's like not a spoiler. It's like the whole point of the movie is you start out knowing we're like, well, she's going to die, I guess.
Right. Which I love that they did that, because it lets you enjoy the film almost, because you know what's going to happen. You forget about it, because I know when I first watched it, I had completely forgotten by the end of it. Like, and then of course, as she, spoiler, starts to get sick and like has the coughs and the tuberculosis is like infecting everything, you're like, oh, that's right, she's gonna die. And it's just, it's still emotional, it's still heartbreaking, and it still affects you in a way that great films do when you have these spoilers. And it was a very interesting choice, for sure.
It's interesting because it spoils the film in a couple different ways. Because not only are you aware that she's going to die from the very beginning, but you're aware, I guess, like, we've all seen movies, we all know that, but, like, Christian and Satine are going to have a relationship, because at the beginning, like, it takes a while for them to actually get there, and she's pushed him away, and she's this inaccessible person, but we start out and we're like, okay, so they're going to get together, and then she's going to die at the end, and we're aware of those big blocks of the film.
Yeah, which is... it's very interesting that that was the decision to be made. Because again, you're like, oh, well, of course he's gonna, it almost balances out, movie tropes and the fact that, oh, of course the first person you see is going to fall in love with the first person of the opposite sex that they meet, and they're going to have, you know, a meet cute and blah, 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 blah. Whereas this almost cuts through that by stating, yes, this is what is going to happen. They're going to fall in love. And she's going to die. Now let's get on with the story.
Let's not waste time worrying about all of this.
Don't question the plot devices. Just watch.
My interpretation of this movie is you have this gorgeous love story at the center. And there's a lot of other stuff going on surrounding it. We have the Moulin Rouge, and we have it being in financial trouble. We have the Duke, who is that we create this love triangle, and the Duke is this vicious person, and Satine has to pretend to be in love with him. And we have more minor subplots, and we have the Bohemian singing about truth, beauty, freedom, and love. But I think there is when you take a step back and look at it, there's all this stuff going on in this movie, but I think that most of it is given almost no time beyond what is directly supporting the love story. I think all of it is just created to give more dramatic tension to this.
Yes. Whereas, you know, again, a lot of people would do it differently. They would build up these side stories to make it more of a complex, like, plot, and, like, let's add more intricacies to everything. Whereas by having these as plot points, you know, it heightens that everyone's choices, and it heightens the needs both for Christian and Satine's, their decisions that they're making. And the plot has, you know, these regimented steps that need to happen, but it doesn't overwhelm the storyline, which is the love story, period. And that, capital letters, all caps, exclamation points. The love story is the most important thing, which, I mean, let's be honest, that is the whole point of everything. You know, the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. So why would they have the story, the plot for the movie, be anything other than that?
Yeah, no one walks out of the Moulin Rouge thinking, wow, that was an interesting breakdown of class dynamics in Paris.
Right. Right. Yeah, nobody's going to talk about that.
Yeah, it's all just the backdrop to Christian and Satine, our beautiful star-crossed lovers.
Yes.
This movie is also responsible for why my best friend was in love with Ian McGregor, probably still is in love with Ian McGregor, from the time she was like 11.
She has very good taste.
Yeah, I must have seen Star Wars before I saw this movie, but this is a much greater impression of, like, Ewan McGregor's roles to me. This is what I know him from the best.
Yes, for sure. It influenced my need to watch the movie Down with Love, which is another delightful musical, in which Ewan McGregor is the star, and so I hadn't seen Moulin Rouge after seeing Down with Love. I just recently watched Down with Love again a couple months ago, and the vocalizations that Ewan McGregor does when singing are very, very similar to his character in Down With Love. So I don't know if that, like, if it was on purpose, or if that's just how he sings and doesn't, like, because when you're singing, you can choose to make stylistic choices in how you are singing. And some people can change that with their character. So I don't know if he just chose to do the songs the way that he would do them as Ewan McGregor, or if that was like, let's tie this in. How cool would that be if I'm going to sound the same way that I sound as Christian singing as whatever the character's name in Down With Love is?
I do think he does a great job. I haven't seen Down With Love, so I'm not really sure. I'm trying to think I've seen him. Well, he was in Beauty and the Beast. He was Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast. So I guess he sings
in that.
Oh,
that's right.
He's singing with like a French accent, so it's hard to judge.
Yes. Yes, it's very true. Very hard to judge that.
He's also a candle, so.
A candlestick.
It's a candelabra.
Yes. He's holding the candles, obviously. Come on, Quinn.
Sorry, I must be more professional about this.
Yes. How dare you not use the proper terminology?
And then, of course, alongside Ewan McGregor, we have Nicole Kidman, who does a phenomenal job as Satine.
Yes, I am not a fan of hers, necessarily. This is pretty much the only movie that I enjoy her in, and I don't know exactly why that is, but she is a phenomenal actress, an amazing singer, great dancer, all of that. I don't know why necessarily I don't tend to like the characters that she produces. Something about like her raspy, whispery voice in every movie that she's in, but it works for this one for some reason.
It does embody, you know, not only sort of her role as this sex symbol, mysterious Moulin Rouge character, but also as a woman dying of tuberculosis. It kind of manages to get both in there.
Yes, that's very true.
Also, I just have to say, I just clicked on her Wikipedia page and she has a subheading that's just labeled continued success. And I'm like, yeah, she's doing all right.
Yeah, she's fine. She has,
but she was nominated for an Academy Award for her role in Moulin Rouge, which she did not end up winning, but still, like, that is pretty exciting.
Yes. Yeah, no, especially, I mean, the fact that this movie, it was nominated for a lot of things, and it got rave reviews from both, like, the audience and critics and whatnot, and it really helped bring all of these movie musicals together and have a very stylistic idea of, we want to have all of this dancing and over the top, like, let's do things that they can't do on stage on film, but still have, because they did about 9 months of rehearsal for the movie, which most movies, that's not how you do it. You might have a couple weeks before filming if it's very complicated, but otherwise each actor will get their script and then they'll go and they'll film. And so they had all of this rehearsal because of all the dancing and movements and stuff. And so in a bunch of the interviews, they talk about how it felt very much like a stage show because they had the rehearsal and they really bonded and they got to know each other as family. And so I'm thinking of one of the special features they have. It's the scene where they, where the Duke has a hissy fit and wants to change the ending. But the part that really stood out in this snippet of backstage life during rehearsing was the fact that John Leguizamo, who plays Toulouse-Lautrec and is, of course, on his knees the entire time, he has a baby in a carrier on the front who is maybe a month or two old. So his partner gave birth during rehearsals, and he takes the baby on set to rehearse. And so every so often you're seeing him bouncing the baby in the carrier while holding his spot like he's supposed to. And I was just like, how amazing is that? That these rehearsals have developed, you know, the relationships to where that's a totally acceptable thing to do.
I love that. I love being able to see the relationships and the connections that are built on a project that is this large.
Yeah. And I think, I saw something where Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor met at some award show again, and they just like hit it off again, because of course they spent almost a year together. Like they're going to remain friends, very much like Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet are. So it's one of those movie couples that you're rooting for friendship.
Forever and always. Because how can you not, when you spend that much time together, sharing that much emotion?
Yeah.
Slightly overdramatic emotion at times, because, you know, Baz Luhrmann.
Right.
But still valid.
Yes.
So at this point, I think it's time to dive into the stage show some. Obviously still going back and forth with the movie and the stage adaptation, but I'll also just generally fire off the spoiler horn. So if you don't want to know, I mean, more stuff about what happens in this movie, or if you don't want to know about the differences in the stage adaptation, just might want to head out now.
Thanks for joining the beginning of this podcast episode.
But I do want to talk about stuff because I went to see the stage adaptation a couple weeks ago at the Emerson Colonial Theater in Boston, and I loved it and I had a really good time. It was so fascinating. So it starred Aaron DeVate and Karen Olivo, which is a big, big reason why I wanted to go, is because I love Aaron DeVate more than life, and I've never seen him live, so that was a big priority for me. And I love Karen Olivo. I went to see In the Heights when it was on Broadway, but it was after she left, and I was always kind of sad that I never got to see her in it, and so I was like, I gotta make good on this and go see her in this show instead.
Yeah, which works out. And I am still so heartbroken that I wasn't able to make it. I tried. I was going to fly from Portland to Boston. I've been like thinking about this multiple times for multiple people. And I just, the flights cross country are ridiculous. And I just could not justify it. But it's very heartbreaking.
Well, the good news is,
but someday
this show is definitely going to transfer to Broadway. Like, it hasn't been officially announced yet, but it's expected to transfer in 2019, either for this season or next year's season. And so I have total faith you will be able to see it sometime, Kathy.
Yay. I'm so glad, because this is my show. This is my jam. And we'll talk about it when we get to the questions that you ask. But, come what may is my thing. That is my phrase, my quote. I walked down the aisle to the soundtrack version of Come What May. Like, that is the, that's what my tattoo is. It says Come What May, from all of Ryan's stroke stuff. The whole idea that, you know, whatever happens, I still love you. We're going to make this work. Like, this will, like, this, it's kind of been our relationship quote too. And so this is, yes, Moulin Rouge is my jam.
have slightly bad news.
Uh-oh.
Kamo Mei is still in the movie. I mean, it's still in the show. Absolutely. Like, of course it is. But you know okay. how in the movie it's like every other thing that they say or saying is come what may?
Yes. Yeah.
It's not like that in the show, which is one of the main things that I noticed. It is still in there, I promise. I was just like, wow, a lot less come what may than there was in the movie.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because I have it in my life. I don't need it in the show.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, one of the big reasons that it wasn't the whole show kind of is because they had a lot more new music because there's been 17 years since the movie came out. And I think they basically looked at it and said, how many songs have come out in the last 17 years? Let's get all of them.
But did overall, did they, still stick? Like, is Come With Me, is Come What May the only original song? Is the rest the intricate changed covers that they do?
Yes. As far, okay. I don't remember every single song that was added, but it's, I don't remember thinking like, oh, this is a song I haven't heard before. Like, I pretty much recognized all of them. They, and of course they still kept, like, they kept Come What May, Your Song, Elephant Love Medley, Roxanne. So they kept like everything that you would want to see from the movie. They basically still had in there. They took out the whole Like a Virgin scene, which I think I and everyone else was fine with.
That, yeah, that scene, while a great feat of male dancing, definitely did not further the plot necessarily. I can see that choice. Did that change the plot? Like, do they still had that as an excuse that Ziedler gave that she was confessing, or okay, let's take a step back. How did the plot change? Did the plot change at all with the additional songs?
Yes, somewhat. It wasn't like there were any major plot differences, but it was mostly differences in character, more like. They did a lot of different nuances to what the characters were.
Interesting.
And the biggest change was the Duke. Because in the movie, the Duke is kind of like... he's kind of like this toad guy. Like, he's not very attractive. He's not charming at all. He's like very explicitly, he is bad. He is gross. In the show, one, he is super hot. Like that was a decision that they made. And Ooh. He is still, you know, he still treats the teen like an object. He still has serious anger issues, is violent and threatening, but he is also somewhat charming. He genuinely gives her stuff that she wants. He's presented as a genuine option because he does present everything that Satine has stated that she wants in the world, and he's not, you know, outwardly explicitly gross. So it's this bigger question. I mean, like, I've seen the movie, so I know, but I think it's supposed to be presented as this bigger question of maybe right. Satine will actually choose the Duke in the end genuinely because it's better for her in her life. And sure, you know, he objectifies her in every sense of the word, but he also, like, has these things that he can give her.
Yeah. I wonder if in the movie the decision... The thing we talked about earlier, about how, like, each of these side plots are kind of just, like, supplemental to the story, by having the Duke not this creepy, gross, oh, obviously she's never going to pick him type of a thing, if it was to build the story overall, to make it more intricate, to make it not just about the love story, but also to have more believability. Like, when I'm guessing she, like, says she doesn't want to love Christian in order to save him, like in the movie. And so by having it more believable, it makes the, I'm going to come and shoot, give you all of the money for the horror you are, bit at the finale more believable.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot more time given to the pressure of the Moulin Rouge. It's very much drilled in that, like, if Satine does not secure the Duke and keep the Duke happy, then the Moulin Rouge will go under because he owns it now. From, like, that he signs on and he gives them the money they need to survive, but he also takes controlling interest in the property. So if Satine goes back and, like, chooses Christian, then she's not only, like, giving up the Duke and what he can offer her, she's also basically damning her friends, and they spend more time on her relationship with Ziedler and the other dancers there and making it clear that they're a family.
Mm. Yeah, that was something, like, I wanted to learn more about the dancers. They had all of these great characters and the characterizations, and pretty much we see them during the Can-Can and during Roxanne, and that is it.
Yeah, you don't get a ton more of them, but you do get more interaction with them backstage. You see their own fears as to what's going to happen to them. There's one song that they add, that Shake It Off, not the Taylor Swift version, the Florence and the Machine song. And it's it's this interesting interlude, almost, with Ziedler and Satine and a few of the dancers encouraging each other and bringing each other up and trying to face this terrifying world together, which I thought was a really nice moment outside of the primary love triangle story.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that it sounds like the whole fact of creating a stage show has allowed the story to expand, because with the movie you have, well, and this was back before, you know, 2-hour films were acceptable in the theater. So I think it's 90 minutes. I don't remember exactly how long the movie is, but it's not the big, long 2 hours that it could be. It is 2 hours. Okay. 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Oh, that's a long
Never mind. Ignore that. We could cut that in post.
But it's also, I mean, the stage show is like 3 hours long, though. So it definitely there still has a lot more time.
Yeah. Okay. That extra hour. That, yes. More time. More time is added.
Yeah. I don't know. With out-of-town tryouts, which this is, it'll probably be cut down and changed before it opens on Broadway, because typically shows start out longer and kind of get pared down to more like 2.5 hours instead of the like 2 hours and 50 minutes, which I think was about what this one was. So I don't know how some stuff will definitely be changed or taken out or possibly added before it's sort of set for real, but this is what my impression of it was in the beginning. I do. There's a lot of songs that they added. I don't even remember all of them, but I did want to talk. Just want to give a shout out to a couple of them, because first of all, a lot of the songs, especially in the first act, or play at least a little bit for laughs. Like at one part, the Bohemians start singing Royals. And I mean, it's funny because as soon as you recognize it, you're like, oh, haha, I see what you did there.
Right. Oh, that's
funny. But I want to give a shout out to Karen Olivo singing Firework. So she started to sing Firework by Katy Perry, and it's this solo of her alone in her dressing room singing it to herself. And she starts to sing, and there's like a couple little laughs from the audience, and then they cut out because everyone sort of feels it like, no, this is not funny. This is serious. And then she kills this gorgeous solo of Firework. Now, they did take out the line about feeling like a paper bag because I think they realized that would be too far. but she did turn this into, I mean, it's a serious song when it was released initially, but I think it's become a little bit, because it's such a pop song, it's a Katy Perry song, and people wouldn't necessarily take it as seriously. But not only does she sing it as a completely seriously, she sings it heartbreakingly, and you see the incredible pain that's been in her life as she's trying to pull herself together. I'm like, Katy Perry has never made me feel this way.
That's amazing. Because, yeah, the song, when it first came out, was very much a look at how, like, emotions and feelings and all of the feelings. And then it just became this, like, 4th of July anthem, like, running joke almost. And so the fact that she managed to pull it off into this serious, like, heartfelt version that it was originally meant to be is impressive. That's exciting.
Yeah. And I mean, there's tons and tons of other songs that are added seriously or fun songs and great dance numbers. And a lot of the initial medleys and songs from the movie are included, but they are added to, especially Elephant Love Medley. I don't even remember what songs are in there, but they must have added at least a dozen more songs into it and really expanded it, which I thought was awesome.
That's so exciting. I'm so excited. So excited.
Oh, and that also brings me to how Baz Luhrmann was the stage show of this question.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Basically, it is true that there's not so much that you can add when so much of the style of the original movie was down to camera cuts. And so I do think that there's an element of that that is lost and is just impossible to recreate on stage. But in terms of the atmosphere of the show, I think in costuming and set, they absolutely nailed what the movie was. It is opulent, it is spectacular, it is luxurious and scandalous, and everything that the movie was is brought to life in living color. And the scene that I was most impressed with that they managed to pull off is at the end of Elephant Love Medley in the movie, they are lifted into this fantasy cloud world of stars and the Eiffel Tower, and they did that on stage.
Oh my goodness. Okay, my very, very important question for this. Did they have the man in the moon?
Oh, I don't think so. I wasn't looking for him.
I hope so. I hope. Okay, because that, again, not to go back to the special features on the movie for a millionth time, but I'm totally going there anyways. One of the new special features they had was the filming of the Man in the Moon part of it. And so it was Jim Broadbent as the Man in the Moon, and he has this like they glued a moon to his face and like did the makeup around it. So he's got this round circle, like round flat thing attached to his face, and then he's all in black for filming. And so they're like walking him through to get the visuals that they want. And they're like, oh, your children are over here and look over here. And oh, I want you to come into the camera. And like, it was amazing and made me pay attention to the Man in the Moon during the movie so much differently, because I'd always recognized that there was somebody there, but I didn't know who it was. And I didn't like even process like the filming of it. And so it was a really, really interesting like peek into the back end. And so now I'm really curious to see if they, cause they could do it with like lighting and whatnot to have it projected into the back, for the Man in the Moon if they wanted to. And so now I'm really curious to find out if, he makes an appearance.
Oh no, that's fascinating. No, I don't think he was there, but I was really distracted because they used fog machines and lights basically to achieve most of the effects in that scene. Mm-hmm. And they turned the whole thing into this starry night sky, and I was just kind of sitting there with my mouth hanging open, so I may not be the most reliable source.
Understandable.
I'm trying to think if there was any other big changes that would be important to bring up. I think it was mostly just a matter of, like I said before, characterizations. Oh, the other big one, the big character change was with the Bohemian French name that I can't pronounce. What was it?
Toulouse-Lautrec?
Yeah, him.
Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, and with other words in the middle, but yes.
Yes, hold on. Him. So his characterization was a lot different, and for one, he is not played by a little person, which, like, well, he wasn't in the movie either, but they made it look like that because he is actually a historical character who was a real-life painter in the Moulin Rouge. So they definitely go away from as much as you can consider anything in the Moulin Rouge historical accuracy. But the actor for him did an amazing job, and they created more depth for him and gave him a whole backstory in that he has known Satine since they were very young, and he actually is in love with her. And so this is part of his relationship with Christian, is encouraging him to pursue Satine because he realizes that he missed his chance and will, like, they are still friends, and he missed his chance to ever express how he feels to her, and so he encourages Christian to not miss that chance.
Oh, interesting. That's really interesting. So did they have him with any sort of his, because famously he basically has the disease that's called the Toulouse-Lautrec syndrome, but obviously it wasn't called that when he had it, where your bones basically just stop growing and they're very, very delicate and they break. And it's the same thing that one of the Scottish clan brothers in Outlander has. So if you've read the books or seen the show, that's the thing. And so basically they start as a normal person, and then as they get taller, their bones just in the legs stop growing and they break super easily, and it just is a horribly painful, painful disease, and it's awful.
He's played by an actor who has average body proportions, but he does use a cane.
Okay.
And is imitating some of the symptoms, so they don't remove that element entirely, but
okay.
So it is still visible on stage at some points.
Interesting. Well, and that makes sense. Maybe they're just like, oh, it's earlier in the disease part or something. I don't know. They made decisions. That works.
Yeah. So that was, I think, the other quite large character difference that was made in this whole backstory that they give him. And he has more screen time, stage time, and more songs in there, which I think is a nice element with Christian's relationship with the Bohemians. Also, the narcoleptic Argentinian, I think, is just not narcoleptic anymore. Like, that wasn't really a thing either. He's just Argentinian now.
Oh. I mean, that's okay to have Argentinian, but that... So, they... Because, I mean, that was one of the main plot points on how Christian was able to... Well, first, how they met. How Christian met the Bohemians, and then how he got on stage for the finale. So did he, how did Christian meet the Bohemians, and then how did he get on stage for the end? And feel free to tell me that he didn't, and they totally changed that part of the plot.
He meets the Bohemians just on the street. Like, they're just walking by trying to write the song, and he just jumps in, and you're like, okay.
That's fine.
The ending is roughly the same. I think that the ending in the stage version does not land as well, and that there are more issues, and hopefully they will fix those issues, because, you know, there are these lines from the show that they've been rehearsing throughout. They did keep in the scene in the middle where Christian, like an idiot, yells, "Because she doesn't love you," instead of keeping in character. And I'm like, Christian, you're so dumb.
Right. You're so dumb.
But they also, now that I'm thinking about this, they do change it. And so they're having Christian in this role throughout. And then he leaves, and he is ostensibly like left town or whatever, when it all starts going down and Satine rejects him and tells him that he needs to leave. And so then they have someone else step into the role. And then he's doing the first lines, and then Christian shows back up on stage, and they just look at each other, and then the other guy leaves, and he's like, okay. I don't know what the audience was thinking at this point.
So does this mean that Christian was cast as the love interest instead of the Argentinian?
Yeah, so he was doing that part the entire time.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And then at the end, they had, like, I think it was the Argentinian. It must have been they had him doing the role instead because Christian was missing. And then Christian came back and did the line again anyway. So they're doing this part on stage. And then, you know, Satine dies. Spoilers. The thing is, I didn't feel like the ending worked as well because, one, I think the lead up to Satine's death was not as... I mean... dramatic is the right word. I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't think it was as dramatic as the movie. Because, I mean, the movie had lots of, like, close-ups and slow motion and shots of the blood on the handkerchief. And you're aware that she's dying through different parts, but it's kind of like, oh, you're dying. And she's like, okay. And then suddenly she's, like, drops dead. And I just feel like that could have been... there could have been more there. And also... we have this whole lead up in this whole show of Christian has to leave town or the Duke's going to kill him. And that the Duke is this horrible power over their entire relationship and all this stuff. Christian shows up at the end, has an extended scene with Satine on stage, and the Duke literally does not appear. He's just not there.
What?
And he does not come back.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
That was the thing I really didn't like. Because I was like, where is the Duke? There is no explanation for where the Duke is or why he does not show up and try to kill Christian. Like, all you would have to do is have him try to show up and have Ziedler get rid of him like he did in the movie. Like, why is he just not there?
Right. You would think that that would be important for him to be there.
Yeah, that was the weird thing. I liked a lot about the stage version. I think they did so much great. I think that the actors did a great job, but the ending was just like, this does not work. And I might have missed something, but like, I think that if a theater goer is paying attention the entire time misses something that big, then you have a problem anyway.
That's very true. Yeah. And hopefully, well, and that's the fun part / sad part about seeing previews before they get to Broadway is that what you see is not what's going to change. Or wait, that what you see is not necessarily the final be all end all of the show.
The other sad part is there's no cast album. Oh my God, that's the worst.
I know. There's not even a list of the songs that are in the show because I tried to do my research beforehand, and there's nothing.
There's nothing. It's so... ugh.
And it's just like, why?
I cannot wait until this transfers to Broadway and they make a cast album and then we can all listen to it forever.
Yes. Yes. I'm very excited for that. Because at least Hadestown has a live cast recording of sorts. But that's a whole other conversation.
Coming soon. Ish, yes. To a podcast player near you.
Yeah, my plan, and I'm hoping that Moulin Rouge transfers in this time frame, is next spring make a trip to New York to see Hadestown and hopefully Hamilton on Broadway and hopefully Moulin Rouge. That's my plan. So, all right, universe, make this happen.
Fingers crossed that Moulin Rouge transfers in time. Yes. I think they will. I think they're probably going to try to get into the 2019 Tony season because I think they can make it unless they think they have too many changes to make. But I think they're going to do it.
I'm excited.
Well, now that I've spent like 20 minutes ranting about the stage version, I haven't been able to talk to a lot of people about this.
I'm glad I could be here for you. And thank you for being here for me because, again, there is nothing online at all for this. And like I mentioned, this this movie has been a big part of my life and a big part of everything and very influential in the fact that I couldn't find anything to feed my happiness desire was very frustrating.
I'm here for you.
Thanks.
All right. Are you ready for the lightning round?
Yes. Bring it on.
Okay. I think you might have mentioned this a little bit, but your favorite song
is Come What May. And very, very specifically, the soundtrack version. Like, I enjoy the new version that they came out with the, oh my gosh, I can't remember his name. But with the music video that they did to promote the show. It's great. But the song from the soundtrack of the movie will always hold such a very special place in my heart because the instrumental in the beginning was when the flower girl walked down the aisle, and then at the big part before he starts singing is when the doors opened and I walked down the aisle for my wedding. So that specific version is the one in my brain as my favorite.
That is so beautiful. And what is your favorite line from this musical?
So granted, since I don't know the show, I had to pick from the movie itself. And I'm torn. I have two for very, very different reasons. The first is thank you for curing me of my ridiculous obsession with love, which is what Christian yells as he throws the money at Satine on stage. And it's one of my favorites just because the raw emotions in that are so palatable. Like, you can just feel the rage and the anger and the fact that he still loves her. And I get emotional every time I see it. And then, of course, my favorite line overall that just makes me happy is the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. Because love is so important in my life. I love people very easily. And I love love and I love loving and all of that. And it just, that hits really hard. And then I guess, of course, also Come What May is kind of a favorite line, but since that's my favorite song, I didn't quite put it in there. So I went with top four rules. I hope that was okay.
There's a lot of good lines in this movie.
There really are.
All right. Who is your favorite character?
I love Harold Seedler. I love him so much. Jim Broadbent is fantastic. And I'm excited to see who they have cast and how that works in the show. But in the movie, I love his passion for the show, his passion for the Moulin Rouge, how much he loves his cast and the family that he creates, and how he's willing to do whatever it takes, but also how much he loves performing. The whole fact that he gets to be the Maharaja and how that comes about, where Satine is just like, oh, of course, nobody could play it like you. With his ego and how he manages to navigate this world between the debauchery of the Moulin Rouge with, you know, the bourgeois that come to see. And I love his character very much.
If you could play one character, who would it be?
Well, in the movie, I'd love to be the narcoleptic Argentinian just because I love a tango. Give me a tango. And that's the one song that I could probably, my range could hit, which is very, it's on the lower end. I am the furthest thing from a soprano you could ever see. But so in college, I took ballroom dancing classes, and one of the things was to dance the opposite position. So I was the leader and my male partner was the follower, and we kind of played around with the tango that they did in Moulin Rouge, which was really, really fun. And so I would love to be the narcoleptic Argentinian.
Who would you recommend go see this show or watch the movie?
Anyone that loves musicals in their rawest state. That's the thing. The movie is very, very raw. It's very frantic, very frenetic, very just like overwhelming. So anyone that enjoys, you know, Mamma Mia or Chicago or any of those other movie musicals, or someone that really wants the essence and emotions to be like just right there.
And finally, if you could combine this show with one other, which would you pick?
I was torn because I really would love to see it with The King and I. They both have such beautiful costumes and just very full with the corset type of a feel. But a show that would actually work mixed together, I think, would be Cabaret. And just putting Cabaret with the Moulin Rouge would be a show I would totally watch.
I could see that. I can see that. All right. And that is all for me. Thank you so much for being on, Kathy.
Thank you so much for having me, Quinn. And I can't wait to come back to talk about more exciting shows.
More musicals.
Yay!
Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theencompo.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you would like, you could also review us on Apple Podcasts or recommend us on Overcast. Until next time, don't forget, the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. A philosophy that also applies to podcast reviews. We'll be right back.